Good morning, 7:38 here on the Mighty 690. It's a Wednesday. That means we get to chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Joining us, we have Wendy Powell and Jesse Gilmore. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good to have you in here. So, first of all, any events that we have coming up? I know we're straight in the middle of, you know, fair craziness, especially here with the Interstate Fair and Rodeos. So, but any other events?
Yes, so coming up on September 6th, we're going to do a field day at Yates Center, which I know is a little far north for folks here in Coffeyville area, but it'll be some really great information. It's called the Bresner Field Day. That's what we're calling it because the Bresner pasture is up there. They've done lots of prescribed burning up there. They've looked at some parasite control, like ticks and flies and things. That's where they've been doing the research on the garlic and the different things and the minerals and fly control, all of those factors. So that's going to be a really great field day in Yates Center on September 6th. And then also September 28th is the Beef Stalker Field Day at Manhattan. I haven't seen the lineup for that, but that's usually a really great educational field day with lots of industry leaders and a nice little trade show with that. So that's September great. 6th and September 28th.
Okay. Now, yeah, go ahead.
I did also want to let people know we've got a couple weeks before this starts, but Master Gardener training is about ready to kick back up. So if you've ever been interested in being a Master Gardener, you can do the training either online or in person at Parsons. We are doing an in-person training this year, but online is about 13 weeks on Thursday from 1 to 4. There are recorded options if you can't make the live version, and it's basically just a crash course in horticulture, lots of different topics. The other thing I wanted to bring up is on September 6th, we will have our garden hour for the month, and I will actually be doing the garden hour on seed saving. So that is also available on Zoom from noon to 1 if anyone is interested.
Very good. So either of you been out to the Interstate Fair and Rodeo yet?
I have not.
Okay. I haven't
okay.
either.
I didn't know if how many of you had official duties over there and that sort of thing.
I'll be out there on Friday.
Okay. Well, that's great. Well, I've been out a couple times. Lots of livestock, of course. So. Mm-hmm. They're all getting ready and lots of work those kids are putting in there. So It's always exciting. Well, hey, we have, of course, hay harvest still going on right now. I know there's a lot of nice looking hay bales around the KGGF towers as we that we were talking through right now. And, of course, there's always some good information that we want to share between that and just general grazing information, too. So where do you want to start with this, Wendy?
Yes. Well, I first just want to... I've been getting a lot of calls this week about this little bit of rain that we've had and how that's going to affect the toxicity levels of our grasses. So a lot of folks are aware that there can be problems, but sorting through the problems and what causes them and what we do about them, that's where the water gets muddied up a bit. So there's really two different issues that can arise when we're talking about like Johnson grass, sorghum sedans, hay grazer, those heavier types of summer annuals that we're growing. A lot of folks might have planted those just to make sure we had enough forage to get through the winter as well. So I'll first mention nitrate toxicity. It's the one that never goes away once the plant is harvested. So once you have nitrate issues in the plant, you're best to leave that plant growing a little bit longer so that it can use up all of those nitrates that it's taken up into the plant. As it continues to grow, it will work through those nitrates. But once the plant is harvested, it will lock in the nitrates. And depending on what concentration level that nitrate is, that's when we can see problems. So not all animals are susceptible to all levels of nitrate. So 0 to 3,000 parts per million is virtually safe. And when we get into 3,000 to 6,000, industry standards is more like 4,500. We can get into safe situations using that nitrate feed on animals that are not stressed. But once we get higher levels of parts per million nitrates into these hays, then that's when we really need to be mixing that hay with something else so that it's more diluted. So dilution is the solution to the pollution. That's our catchphrase there. So that's nitrates. Once the plant is harvested, it's locked into the plant.
So this is kind of a normal, if you will, biologic or process or whatever. These nitrates are just kind of naturally occurring that happen to be a sort of toxin.
Yeah. So whenever we harvest our, when we fertilize our hay fields, that's when we can increase the risk of these nitrates. Certain situations, so like going from a severe drought like we had last summer, and then all of a sudden we had a drought-ending rain, then that new growth had potential problems. But right now, at least in my neck of the woods, we haven't seen a lot of nitrate issues just because we've had some timely rains. Even though we're behind in our rainfall, this year has been sort of okay. The problem we are seeing this year, though, is prussic acid poisoning. That's the one that's essentially cyanide. And so it has the opposite effect, where nitrates block oxygen from being transported in the blood. Prussic acid actually keeps the oxygen from transferring to the cells where it needs to be. So the symptoms look the same, but what's going on inside the body is kind of the opposite. So prussic acid poisoning can happen whenever we're using Johnson grass, Sedan grass. There's not many folks around here that use shatter cane, but we can also have problems with cherry trees. Usually millets are not a problem, so that's something that is considered safer. Those are the plants that we need to be concerned about. If you're going to graze those, we need to be testing these for prussic acid. And we have a nice, easy, quick test available at the extension offices. But sampling is a problem. Not necessarily a problem, but it's very particular. So most of the time with our forage, nitrate toxicity, and with just regular quality testing on our hay, we can just take a sample out of the hay bale. It's not a big deal, and we send that to the lab. No special shipping treatment, things like that. But for our prussic acid, so the prussic acid is stored inside those cell membranes, and as soon as those cell membranes start drying down, then the prussic acid is released. So it's very specific on our sampling process to make for sure that the plant does not lose those gas factors. So whenever you're sampling them out of the field and you have to cover them and get them put into a trash bag or something and zip tie it, so make sure it's nice and sealed, and then we can get that tested if the plant is that large. So
Wendy, would over-fertilization with nitrates to get more biomass in your hay, would that lead to a greater possibility of prussic acid poisoning, or is it largely disjointed from how much you fertilize?
So it can be a factor. The prussic acid is caused by an imbalance of the nitrates and phosphorus. So if your soil nutrients are balanced, then you're probably going to be fine. I still encourage folks to have their forage tested to confirm, because a test is way cheaper than a dead animal. So just have it tested. It's more about that soil nutrient balance than anything else, and then that rain whenever those nutrients are going up into the plant. So whenever you're sampling these plants for prussic acid, make sure you keep them as covered as possible, you know, out of the sunshine. Don't put them on the dash of the feed truck, and then if a few hours later, bring it into the extension office. But if it's something that we're going to be shipping to the lab, then we actually need to get those chilled, and we actually ship those with like a cold pack.
Okay.
So it's very specific, because we don't want those samples drying down and giving us false negatives.
Sure. No, that'll make sense.
So with the nitrate toxicity, it's simple enough to send that to the lab and get our results. With the prussic acid, if you're going to graze those, then we need to do some quick tests in the field, and we've got those at the extension offices. Give us a call for sampling procedures and for like an appointment. We can either meet you in the field or we can meet you at the extension office, whatever works, and we can get those done. It takes between 10 and 30 minutes to get those results with our quick test, and then we can determine if they need to be sent on to the lab to determine the quality. So our quick test is only quantitative. Prussic acid is present, yes or no, and then we send it to the lab to find out how heavy that prussic acid might be.
Wendy, last year, how many samples did you send off, and how many of them had prussic acid issues, and was it an up year or a down year for that kind of issue?
Last year was very, very hot. I sent off, I don't know, probably 75 samples. A lot of them were high in nitrates. A few of them were high in prussic acid. So it's easy enough to handle prussic acid because it does not stay in hay. So as soon as that plant starts drying down, then the prussic acid dissipates. And so a lot of people aren't as concerned about it as they are nitrates unless they're grazing it.
Now, for either of these, prussic acid or nitrates, if animals are grazing on them, are there any symptoms that, you know, what does these do? How do they actually make them sick? Is there any recourse?
Yeah, so with nitrates, it's both of them are pretty darn fast, a couple hours, sometimes less than that. But if you can catch with a nitrate problem, you can administer some methylene blue. Usually vets will have that. It's not really a common product for producers to have on hand. But that is one antidote that can work against nitrate toxicity. With prussic acid, I'm not sure there is a cure. It's one of those prevention is the best cure. So test first. But the symptoms, like for both of them, like I had said, are the same. Labored breathing, muscular tremors. Eventually, they're going to just kind of collapse. And it's very quick. So in the old days, back when cows weren't quite worth $1,600 a piece, it was pretty common to use a sacrifice animal to kick one out there into a pasture you were worried about. And if that animal was still alive in a few hours, then you could kick out the rest of them.
I can't picture anyone doing that today.
No.
Canary in the coal mine sort of thing. But
yes.
Good grief.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, the other thing is, especially I would think if people are going to be selling hay, I mean, and this is another, you know, really important thing that you want to make sure you do, because that would be a terrible thing to have some, you know, bad hay with some toxicity in it.
Yep, absolutely. So if you're buying hay, I definitely encourage you to have it tested. Ask the seller if they tested it. Make sure you know what types of forages were in it. And if you want to go ahead and go to that expense of testing it yourself, you can. It's not expensive. Less than $20 to have the tests ran, and then plus the cost of shipping. So you're looking at, you know, $30 or $40, depending on the size of your sample, what all tests you want ran at the lab. It's not that outrageous compared to the price of livestock.
Oh, absolutely.
Wendy, I was talking with a stakeholder the other day about how between here and Wichita, they were actually haying corn stover. And you mentioned that dilution is the solution to pollution, mm-hmm. which I like that saying a lot. But what other things are people haying? Like, are they adding crop residues to their hay a lot? I know that in general, well, at least in my experience, that pasture grass has been pretty productive this year, especially compared to last year. But are you seeing any other things added to hay that might potentially add nutritional benefit to the livestock that are consuming it?
Last year, we had a lot of that harvesting of corn stalks, harvesting of soybeans that weren't making, things like that. I have not seen that as much this year. Folks that are trying to increase the nutritional value of certain hays, like maybe a lower quality native grass, even corn stalks, they can ammoniate those and add, definitely increase the crude protein value of those by adding nitrates, that ammoniation process. So that's certainly something that you can do to increase the quality of a bale. If you're going to feed any sort of row crop that was supposed to go you know, full out with like soybeans or something, and that was harvested instead for hay, make sure you know what herbicides were used on it, because there are some herbicides that they use in those row crops that are not safe for livestock. So I worked with a guy last year that he'd already purchased some soybean hay, and then he asked what herbicides were used, and sure enough, those herbicides were not safe for what he was trying to feed. So it's one of those, you've got to make sure you do your research before you spend your money.
Yeah, no, that is a great reminder. Well, Wendy, if people have any questions on this, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, give me a call at the Labette County Extension Office. That phone number is 620-784-5337.
Okay, well, a good topic, and we are going to be coming back with Jesse here in this next segment. Jesse, what are we going to be talking about?
Yeah, we're going to be talking a little bit about storm damage and trees. It's been a while since I have been on a Wednesday morning, and in between then and now, we've had some pretty strong storms over in Crawford County. It's caused a lot of tree failure, and quite a few large trees have had to be removed. So we're going to look at some of the things you should be looking for after strong storms and ways to get trees back into your landscape in a timely manner without risking the future health of that particular tree.
Okay, that'll be very good. So that's all coming up here on the Mighty 690. We have 60 degrees in Coffeyville heading up to a high today of 85. Back here on the Mighty 690 at 8:10. Time to continue our chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension. This segment we have Jesse Gilmore joining us. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Glad it's cooler out. We were just talking about Phoenix and how hot it gets there.
Yeah, it's hot. And this morning, honestly, I was cold. I was like, this is too cold.
I slept with my window open last night. It felt great.
I made sure that they were closed because I knew it would be too cold. Because, you know, my place has an inch and a half insulation, so it's like I'm living in a tent sometimes. So
we'll be up in the 90s for the next 10 days.
I actually kind of thought about busting out the heater this morning. I kid you not. It was just too cold. So anyway, hey, well, we do have, speaking of weather, have had some storms and such move through, and that's been a little bit hard on our trees for a number of reasons.
Yeah, so when you're dealing with storms, you've got two main problems. One that is immediate and very obvious, and the other one is chronic and a little bit more subtle, so you have to keep an eye out for it. The obvious one is lightning. If lightning strikes, you're going to know about it immediately, pretty much, especially if you have a very small yard. I have not had lightning strike very close to me, thankfully, but I was called out to a lightning strike last week in a sweet gum. Lightning is one of those things that you think is always going to kill trees, but actually, surprisingly, trees are a lot more resilient to lightning than you would think. Wood is naturally an insulator, but that does not mean that lightning will never strike wood. Usually due to the liquid that's inside the tree, and that's what ends up getting heated up a lot, because lightning is very hot. It's actually hotter than the surface of the sun, and so that's going to cause some heat damage to the tissue that it strikes as it goes down to the ground. In some cases, like the sweet gum that I was called out to, it's just going to explode the bark off of the tree, and the underlying tissue is at least superficially fine. We're not going to know if it's actually damaged until next year when it starts trying to grow new leaves and green up for the spring. But for this particular tree, the only thing that happened was the bark came off of it. There were no splits in the trunk or anything like that. And so right now, it's not a hazard tree. It has no risk of coming down. You can see the line down the trunk where the lightning ran because it was scorched a little bit, but that was just on the surface. But you do need to watch out for splits in the trunk if you ever do get a tree struck by lightning, because sometimes the tissue is not going to hold up to that lightning strike. There's just so much energy in the lightning. And so if you have a split, you need to keep an eye on the tree and judge how far down the tree the split goes. If the split goes all the way to the base of the tree, that tree is an immediate hazard and it needs to be removed as soon as possible before it comes down on something. But with splits that don't run all the way down the length of the tree, you might be okay. I have seen some very funky looking trees in my life that were struck by lightning and still managed to pull through. But it's never going to be as strong as it was before that split occurred. So that is something to keep in mind if the tree is farther away from anything it could fall on, like buildings or vehicles or people, then it might be worth leaving it in to see if it pulls through. The other more harder to notice thing that occurs with storms is wind damage. Sometimes it will only affect very minor limbs. We had 80 mile per hour winds in the last major storm in Pittsburgh. So that is, I'm sure, what caused a lot of the damage to very large shade trees that people had in their yards. They had to call tree services in to cut them down completely. Because that damage was so severe that it basically split right down the middle all the way to the base of the tree. When you're looking for wind damage, you are really going to see it first in dead branches in the tree still. And that's going to signal a branch that has broken enough of its tissue to not get the water it needs to survive, but has not broken all of its tissue. So it's still hanging on by a thread to the trunk. The damage to the limb is usually pretty jagged, and it might be twisted too. Those you are going to need to get up in the tree and cut out cleanly, so that the tree goes through compartmentalization. When trees have, and most other woody plants, when they have a clean cut wound, they are going to wall off the outermost cells of that wound to prevent decay that might get into the wound, like the surface of the wound, from moving further into the tree. That only really works if it does have a clean cut, though. If it's a jagged injury like what you would see with wind damage, it's not going to go through that process. Decay can get into that wound and then make its way further into the trunk, which can be problematic depending on how low on the tree it occurs at. But decay is always the first thing you need to look for when you have old storm damage. New storm damage won't have enough time to decay, but it's always a good idea to go out and scout your trees after a major storm like the ones we've had recently.
Well, you know, in this past storm, we had lots of big trees come down. I mean, some of Walter Johnson bark that were pretty big around and a little bit surprising, because you think, oh, you know, the tree looks fine and everything. I mean, is there anything that you can do to identify, you know, trees that may be a little more susceptible to that damage? Or is it just one of those things where it was just a big tree, it had a lot of branches, it got a lot of wind load, and it came down?
Yeah, so when you're looking at damage potential in storms, you're looking at the hardness of the wood, essentially. And there is typically an inverse correlation between how hard the wood is and how fast the tree grows. So when you're getting a tree into your landscape, a lot of people ask me about fast-growing trees, and we'll actually talk about this in just a second. But in general, the faster growing a tree is, the more brittle the wood is going to be. And there's trees that have a bad reputation when it comes to storm breakage. Obviously, ornamental pear is the one that comes up the most. Just because I think it has a tendency to be overplanted, but also because the structure of the tree is just garbage. It's good for visual style. The way it grows, it's... Okay, I'll dive into this now. When you have a tree, you have X-current growth and you have D-current growth. X-current growth is the standard tree. You've got one vertical stem, and then you've got a lot of lateral branches going outward horizontally. Most trees are going to grow like this naturally, but there are some species of trees like redbud, like ornamental pear, like mimosa, that are going to do decurrent growth, where they send multiple stems upwards, and usually pretty early in their life. So these stems are rather sizable. They become, they're basically, they form a V. It's known as a crotch in the tree. And the lower that the crotch occurs on the tree, the more likely you are to have a total tree failure.
Oh, sure.
Because that split forms a junction that can crack or potentially tear off in high winds.
So if you were growing a tree, is there anything you can do to prevent some of that? Like, you know, as far as maybe pruning when they're young and to keep up with that?
Yeah, most people tend to shy away from pruning when young. Like, they don't want to touch the tree. Oh, it's just getting its start in life. I can prune later. Prune early. And in fact, actually, selection goes a long way towards minimizing the work that you're going to have to do. selecting the right specimen at the nursery or the garden center before taking it home and having to prune it will take care of a lot of the issues. Now, obviously, if you're getting a species like redbud, ornamental pear, mimosa that defaults towards decurrent growth, you are not going to fix that with pruning. So instead of trying to force a decurrent growing tree into an excurrent growth pattern, you are instead going to want to make sure that the structure is good for that particular species. You're not necessarily going to want to prune it into the other growth pattern. But making sure, especially if it is an excurrent grower naturally, that you don't have those multiple stems running upward, or if you do have a tree that you really like, but it does have those, to prune those out earlier. Contrary to popular belief, early pruning is not going to hurt the tree in the long term. It's actually going to be better overall than removing more biomass later after the tree has done some growing.
Sure. So these trees that grow slower are going to be stronger in general.
In general, yeah. So oaks are notoriously slow growing. They will have one particular issue that you do need to consider, and that is the potential, I have not seen this very often, but I have seen this, to completely uproot in heavy winds. I have seen two different examples of this. One was in someone's back 40, where 12 different oak trees uprooted in straight line winds. The other one was in a front yard in Girard, and the tree went towards the road and not towards the house, and they were very lucky that it didn't. The reason for that is because oaks, unlike most other trees, are not going to send a taproot down. They are instead going to send fibrous root systems out horizontally, so they don't get a lot of stability from the soil that other trees would. And in general, assuming that you can develop the root system, which there are methods that you can do early in a tree's life in order to encourage as deep of a root system as possible, you're not really going to need to worry about that. And there are some oaks that are actually fast-growing but very good selections for southeastern Kansas, and I wish that more people knew about it, specifically the chinkapin oak and the scarlet oak. Chinkapin oak was Jake Weber's favorite tree. He was my predecessor, and so we planted one for him at the Arboretum. It is a very handsome oak tree. They just put some in the dog park in Pittsburgh, and they did not do anything to them as far as staking, as far as watering, and they are completely healthy looking trees. They don't have a standard oak leaf like most people think of. It's a very odd looking leaf, and you, unless you know what you're looking at, you probably wouldn't even assume they are oak trees, but they are the fastest growing oak tree. So if you are needing a tree that's you want to grow fast, but also be strong, that's a really good middle ground for the compromise between fast-growing and weak-wooded. And plus, people like oaks. It's interesting having oak trees that aren't pin oaks in your landscape. A lot of people will default to white oaks for that. And in general, red oaks, white oaks, there's two main groups of oak trees. White oaks need more work. Chinkapin oaks do not need more work, even though they are a white oak species. But it is important, like I said, to make sure that you are pruning your selections at the, or not pruning, you are selecting the right tree at the garden center for your space and a good specimen in that particular species. Some people have asked me about the Kansas Forest Service sale, like seedling sale, that they always do. Those are conservation grade trees, so they are quickly propagated trees for the purpose of getting something into the ground, just something, and not necessarily the best structure or the best species for what you're needing. So if you keep in mind that conservation grade trees are going to be in lesser quality than what you can buy at the garden center, and assuming you are using them for conservation purposes, those are good choices if you need bulk seedlings. They're not necessarily all going to survive.
Kind of like straight run chickens, maybe, you know, if you're going to do an animal comparison. Perhaps.
Wendy's over here nodding. I'm not familiar with that, but I will take your word for it. But yeah, no, the specimens that you can get at garden centers hopefully are better than conservation grade trees. They're not always going to be. But fall is actually the time that you should be thinking about planting trees if you are interested in planting them. There's a couple reasons for that. The first is that the warm soil will encourage more root growth, which is one of those ways you can encourage deeper roots on oak trees. The other is that you can see the fall color of the trees that you're going to buy at the garden center. So you get a good idea of what your tree is going to look like come autumn.
And what things it may be dropping.
Right. Yes. Sweet gum. Balls, maple samaras. There's a lot of different acorns. There's a lot of different things that could be falling right about now. Pecans, for example. By the way, pecans, one of those weak-witted trees. The best pecan is growing in your neighbor's yard, not yours.
Oh gosh, there's one right above my motorhome.
Well, you're probably you'll get some minor limb droppage. I don't have experience with them dropping major limbs for the most part. Yeah. But what was I saying? Dropping things. So you're going to get an idea of all of the fall stuff. Obviously, fall color is going to be variable. And actually, in the 2 weeks prior to the color change, the amount of sunlight that the tree gets is going to be the biggest factor in determining how strong their fall color is. Because the sunlight in the preceding 2 weeks will determine how much sugar the leaves produce.
Mm, okay.
And so that sugar, the chlorophyll go through one last major photosynthesis period in the 2 weeks prior. And so if it's cloudy, they're not going to get enough sunlight to produce a ton of sugar, and that color is going to be more dull. So take that with a grain of salt when you are out looking at garden center or nursery trees.
Now, what about cottonwoods? Are those native?
Yes, cottonwoods are native. They are our state tree. I'm sure there is a historical reason for it, but I don't see a ton of cottonwoods in our area, surprisingly. They are more of a western tree. They are in the poplar family, which means that they do not deal with heavy, heavy drought. And they're probably doing really good in northwest Kansas right now. They're above average for the last 365 days
on
the rainfall.
And it seems to me I've always noticed them more along like riverbanks and creeks and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so they need water, and that's where they grow in western Kansas too. Yeah, they are the most hardy of the poplar family trees, so I've seen people try and plant white poplars. Some of them survive, most of them don't. Aspens don't even try planting in Kansas. Oh, they're
nasty anyway. We don't like them in northern Minnesota. So
they do not tolerate drought at all. So if you want a poplar family plant, cottonwoods would be a decent choice. You just need to make sure that you get a male cottonwood tree. Because if you get a female cottonwood tree, you are going to get the cotton, and it is going to clog up your AC. And with how hot it has been, I would hate for my AC to go down from cottonwood.
Is there a way to figure that out at the garden store?
I think they're developing one, or maybe that was for Eastern Red Cedars. I think they were developing a way for Eastern Red Cedars for you to tell really early into the tree's life, like within 6 months, if you've got a male or a female Eastern Red Cedar. And the reason for that is largely the same as it would be for cottonwoods, because you want male Eastern Red Cedars so that you aren't getting the berries and completely allowing for woody encroachment into your pasture. It can serve as a windbreak. Wendy's making a face over here. Wendy, do you have problems with Eastern Red Cedars in pasture?
Oh my gosh, yes. They burn really well.
They do burn really well. They also shade out a lot of pasture grass, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So trying to prevent female Eastern Red Cedar trees from making it into the population that is being sold is actually going to be a lot better for pasture owners, because it makes for a really good windbreak tree, assuming you can guarantee that you're not going to get any berries that are then spread by birds into your pasture. And so cottonwood, I don't know that they have the same method of determining that for cottonwoods, but I would imagine it's probably pretty similar to how they're doing that with Eastern Red Cedars. Cottonwoods are great trees once you know for a fact that you're not going to get any cotton out of them. They are very, very big shade trees. There probably are other shade trees I would recommend over them, like tulip poplar. Tulip poplar is a very good structured tree. Nice looking flowers. They're probably the best compromise between ornamental and shade tree that you can get. But cottonwoods are a decent selection. I would just pick quite a few other things first, or at least put the cottonwood far away from your house
sure.
so that you're not getting the fluff.
Well, there's so much that, you know, we can take for advantage when it comes to trees, and you definitely notice the landscape without them. So, hey, Jesse, as we wrap up, anything else you'd like to share, and how can people get a hold of you if they have questions?
Yeah, so we barely touched on planting fall trees. There's a lot of publications we've got that deal with the right way to plant trees and all of the maintenance things that you need to think about when you do plant trees. You can get any publication on planting trees, fall gardening, things like that from our office. Usually we'll send out physical copies, but you can also find those publications on the K-State website. If you do need print publications, you can get in touch with any of our offices. My home office is Gerard. That's 620-724-8233. Or you can email me at jr637@ksu.edu.
Okay. Well, Jesse and Wendy, thanks so much for coming by here today. Enjoy the fair time and all that good stuff. And look forward to chatting with you guys again here real soon.
Thank
you. Sounds good.
And we have open line coming up here in just a few minutes. 62 degrees right now in Coffeyville.